For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week our satchels are packed with accessible stories for World Book Day, including Laura Ellen Anderson with Amelia Fang, Angelique Hugh Ralph with The Boy at the Back of the Class, Alex Rider author Anthony Horowitz, and Ade Adepitan, who takes us on another adventure with Cyborg Cat. Plus, we celebrate the long-anticipated publication of The Mirror and the Light, the concluding volume in Hilary Mantel's Thomas Cromwell trilogy, with a look back at Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies. That's all coming up in today's show. Each year, UNESCO aims to introduce every child to the joy of books and reading through World Book Day. This year, the aim is to share a million stories throughout the UK. And, as always, the RNIB Library is proud to play its part by making sure that every child has access to the great stories on offer. Here's Robert Kirkwood to tell us more.
It was a dark and gloomy Friday night in Nocturnia.
Flop, can I have my Hoppity Voosh book, please?
World Book Day is all about celebrating the magic of books and reading.
Flop thinks the bath is too wet for books.
In schools all over the country, 15 million £1 book tokens will be distributed to children and young people, which can be exchanged for one of 2020's collection of books.
There had been just one visitor that morning, and he had recognised him immediately. Alex Rider.
RNIB is proud to support World Book Day's mission to give every child and young person a book of their own by making 13 titles available in audio and in braille free of charge.
What a waste of time. Books are rubbish. Everyone knows that.
Reading can open up a world of possibilities and enhance the imagination, which is why it is so important for every child and adult to be able to enjoy the books of their choice. The titles this year come in three rough age groups: younger readers, preteens, and young adults. The first younger reader book is Bing's Splashy Story. Join Bing for his favourite bedtime story and find out what happens when it gets drippy wet.
Bing leaves the book on the side of the bath to show Flop how Hoppity twirled in the wind to get dry. The wind goes poof, poof, poof. Bing is so busy twirling that he doesn't see the book go sploosh into the water. Oh, says Flop, fishing the book out of the bath. Oh no, Bing gasps. The water got in my book.
Also for younger readers is Super Tazzle, Books Are Rubbish. It's night time in the supermarket, and all the veggies are happily reading their brilliant books. Well, not quite all. The evil pea thinks books are rubbish.
So, you like to get lost in a good book, do you, veggies? Well, get lost in these! And he threw the books down on top of the veggies. Oh no! Panicked the pineapples. Help! Cried the veggies, bumping into each other in the dark. Ouch! Aubergine shone her torch. Tomato? How can you knit at a time like this?
And for readers getting slightly older, here's Amelia Fang and the Bookworm Gang. A plucky little vampire who's just like you and me. Amelia Fang is feeling very nervous about reading out loud in front of her class, so she decides to practice with her friends in Loose Limb Library. But when they get there, the gang discovers bite marks in every book.
Outside in the Catacomb Academy graveyard, Squashy padoinged over to Amelia happily, waggling his stalk from side to side. Hello, you! Amelia said as the little pumpkin jumped into her arms. Florence waved her Toadstar comic around excitedly in her large hairy paw.
I'm totally going to make up my own superhero story. What are you guys thinking of writing about?
I don't know for sure yet, said Tangine in deep thought. But I do know that it won't end happily. A tragic story with a hint of love.
And here's author of Amelia Fang and the Bookworm Gang, Laura Ellen Anderson, to tell us more about Amelia Fang.
Amelia Fang, so she is a brave and determined vampire, and she goes on lots of adventures with her best friends Florence and Grimaldi, and also Prince Tangine Le Floufou the First, future king of Nocturnia. Over the course of the books, their friendship has really grown and developed, and the books really look at kind of, you know, the bond that they have, and looking at tolerance and acceptance in their world, and they just meet lots of weird and wonderful creatures, and each book sees a new location in the world and takes them on many strange avenues, really. The fact that Amelia Fang is going to be a World Book Day book for 2020 is just really, really good news, because, you know, it's an opportunity for more kids to discover the world and perhaps dress up if they fancy it. I've had some fabulous photos sent to me of various kids dressed up as Amelia Fang and other characters. One of the funniest was a mother sending a picture of her Florence costume, which she ended up using the mask, the head of Florence, as a car seat cover in the end. The more accessible books are to everyone, the better. And to know that everyone can enjoy the books that I'm writing, I think it's fantastic.
The books for preteens start with Evie in the Jungle by Matt Haig. A truly wild adventure. 11-year-old Evie has a talent. She can hear what animals are thinking, and she can even talk to them with her mind.
Evie, give us a smile.
I'm sorry, I'm just tired.
Evie, what do you say to people who say you are a fake?
I'd say ask the scientists who have confirmed I am not.
Evie, do you think fame is going to your head?
I'd rather not be famous, to be honest.
Evie!
Evie's dog Scruff came to her side.
Get a life! He barked at the reporters. Leave Evie alone!
But the reporters didn't speak dog, and so they carried on doing what they were doing.
Next up, Kid Normal and the Loudest Library. This is the epic, never-before-told story of the Super Zero's first-ever active mission as real-life superheroes, a brand-new mini-adventure in the best-selling, award-winning Kid Normal series by Greg James and Chris Smith.
Go on, then. Answer it, prompted Billy, one finger ballooning with excitement. Merv smiled to himself as he contemplated Billy's unpredictable capability, which was to inflate parts of his body or other nearby objects. Billy's cape, as they were nicknamed in the world of heroes, wasn't always completely under his control. But his smile sank beneath the surface once again, as he realised he was about to speak to a secret organisation of superheroes. His brain still hadn't quite processed it.
Next up, the case of the Drowned Peril, a thrilling, murder most unladylike mystery, specially written and published for World Book Day. Daisy Wells and Hazel Wong are best friends, schoolgirls and detectives. When wherever Daisy and Hazel go, a mystery is sure to find them.
The plaque next to the door read, The Last Resort, which made Aunt Lucy and Uncle Felix laugh.
Won't we have a lovely holiday here? Said Uncle Felix.
A holiday? Said Daisy, raising her eyebrow at him. Yes, of course. Won't we? Uncle Felix raised his eyebrow back at her, and for a moment they looked intensely like each other, both so tall and golden and blue.
Do be a good girl, Daisy, he told her. You are here to run about on the beach eating ices. Who Lucy and I happen to meet while we're here? Well, that is no one's business but our own. Do you understand?
And also, The Day We Met the Queen. A heartfelt and humorous news story for World Book Day from Anjali Kuralf, the best-selling and multi-award-winning author of The Boy at the Back of the Class. And here she is to tell us about that book.
The Boy at the Back of the Class is a story about a young narrator who goes to a school, a London school, and one day a very strange young boy happens to walk in. And they're absolutely fascinated by why this boy is quiet and pale and withdrawn and sits at the back of the class. And they discover that the boy is actually a refugee and go on this amazing adventure to try and reunite him with his family. By stripping back the language and questioning what it is we're hearing, which is what children do all the time, we can really get to the heart of this refugee crisis, which is human beings in need. And I think children really latch onto that quite beautifully.
In the World Book Day book, The Day We Met the Queen, 10-year-old Amit has become the most famous refugee boy in the world. In fact, he's so famous, even the Queen wants to meet him.
Can you believe it? Can you believe we're going to see the Queen tomorrow in actual real life? I looked at Michael. We were standing by the bus stop waiting for Tom and Josie. Michael pushed his glasses even farther up his nose and, holding the card to the light, stared at it hard, just like shopkeepers do when they think your money isn't real. But we both knew the invitation was real. The card was so thick it wouldn't let any light through. The writing was fancy and swirly, and there was a thick blob of shiny red wax on the envelope. All those things reminded us that the actual real-life Queen of England had sent it and was expecting us to join her for tea tomorrow.
For young adults, there is My Awesome Guide to Getting Good at Stuff. Best-selling author Matthew Syed is here to bust some myths wide open. So if you believe that you're either born with talent or you're not, that a mistake equals disaster, everyone is hopelessly better than me, then prepare to have your mind blown.
Taking the first step can sometimes seem impossible. But maybe it wouldn't feel so impossible if we knew a little bit more about how people actually get good at stuff. There's a lot of fake news out there, i.e. an awful lot of myths about how the super successful made it to the top. And the even bigger issue is that sometimes people don't want you to know the truth. They don't necessarily want you to know about all the mistakes they made on the way up. They want to keep all of their hard work a secret. Sometimes they want you to believe the myth that they are just naturally brilliant and have been incredible at what they do since the moment they were born.
Also, The Kissing Booth, Road Trip, a super fun romantic comedy short story set in the world of the best-selling book, The Kissing Booth. Everyone knows it's tough having a long-distance relationship, especially when your boyfriend is as sizzlingly hot as Noah Flynn.
Why didn't he want me to book the flights? We'd been planning this trip for weeks. Spring break was coming up, and we decided to mark the occasion with a trip across the country. It was our senior year of high school, but we had been working our butts off to get good grades for college, and we deserved the break. Plus, Noah, my boyfriend and Lee's older brother, was currently in his first year of college in Boston on the other side of the country, which I had to admit was a big factor in me wanting to visit the East Coast. I wasn't entirely selfish, though. Lee's girlfriend of about a year, Rachel, had just been accepted to Brown, which was only an hour's drive from Harvard. Rachel and her parents were going out to take a look around the campus. While I spent time with Noah, Lee would head down to Rhode Island to meet up with Rachel.
Another young adult title is Split by Mohammed Khan. 15-year-old Salma has been caught with her boyfriend in a totally humiliating misunderstanding. Instantly accused of being easy, she is shunned by everyone at school, shamed by her community, and worst of all, has disappointed her mum. Enough is enough, and Salma decides to fight back.
Why would you do that? The betrayal makes me gasp.
Ain't my fault you're so easy.
Wrong answer. My fist connects with his jaw, whipping his face to the left with an audible crack. Rah! Tariq got me too'd! Quips some idiot in the crowd that started to gather now there's a real fight on. Don't ever come at me with your BS again, I yell into his face. Understand?
And also, Alex Rider Undercover. It's written by Anthony Horovitz. And at the Wigtown Book Festival, we asked Anthony if there was a difference between doing a performance for children or adults.
I do love the enthusiasm and the passion and the excitement of children. Adults tend to be a little bit more restrained. So children sort of devour your books and want to know everything about Alex Rider, whereas adults are a little bit more cagey in the way they pose their questions and their responses. But by and large, I think that the pleasure of a literary festival is just that interaction. It's not... I don't see it as being different. That is to say, you know, just talking about books is talking about books, and whether I'm doing it to children or to adults, I don't think that they're that different.
Go undercover into the secret world of the teen super spy Alex Rider in this explosive collection of action-packed short stories.
Everyone always goes on about the value of books and libraries, he had said. But actually, I disagree. If children want to read Harry Potter or Michael Morpurgo at home with their parents, that's all for the better. But education should be about getting a good job, and that means maths, science, engineering, economics, and languages. If we want to prepare young people for the challenges of adult life, I'd say we need fewer libraries and more laboratories. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the future.
Henry Bray disagreed with everything that Milvain stood for.
And finally, available from the RNIB Library, free of charge for World Book Day, are a couple of Welsh language titles that I'm not even going to attempt. Here's Lynn Morgan in Cardiff.
Thanks, Robert. The titles are Darllen Gyda Q by Annie Llin, a colourful book with a short, simple text about Q and her friends. Everybody is very excited as they have a variety of books to read, but which book will appeal most to Q? And for older readers, there's also History in Story Cymru, Iaith a Gwaith by Myrddin ap Dafydd. Both books are available in Wales with your £1 book token and free in accessible formats from RNIB.
The books are available from the library from the 27th of February until the 31st of March. Call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or head to rnib.org.uk/worldbookday.
Thanks, Robert. Something for everyone to enjoy there. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, we mark the publication of The Mirror and the Light by looking back over the first two books in Hilary Mantel's Thomas Cromwell series. But first, Adair Depatan is a busy man. The wheelchair basketball star has a flourishing career as a TV presenter, continues to campaign for disability rights, and has just published the third book in his Cyborg Cat series for children. To ensure the audiobook version was ready in time for World Book Day, he came to the RNIB Talking Book Studios to record it.
Welcome back to Read On, Ade. I hear you've been recording your latest book. Tell us a bit about it.
So this is book three in the Cyborg Cat adventures, Cyborg Cat and the Masked Marauder. Addy and the Parsons Road gang are back on their adventures. They're back, and Addy has got a new nemesis called the Masked Marauder. Addy's on the cusp of making it into the Newham Rollers basketball team, into the under-14s team. He's very good, naturally talented at it. Salim, who was in the earlier books, who was one of the players from the Newham Rollers basketball team, has talent spotted Addy, and he's passed on his talents and mentioned him to the head coach, Carlos, and Carlos is very excited about getting Addy in the team. But the problem is, the wheelchair that Addy has got is not up to scratch. It can't be used in the basketball league. It's illegal. So Addy needs to get a new sports wheelchair. And that chair costs £750, which when you're a 10-year-old kid. Well, when you're anybody is hard to get, but when you're a 10-year-old group of kids, trying to get your head around that sort of money is kind of mind-boggling. But on top of all of that, Addy has still got to convince his parents, who are not comfortable with him using a wheelchair, to allow them to allow him to play wheelchair basketball. And he can't really go to his parents to ask for that money because, one, they don't know he's trying to get into the team, and two, they don't want him to get in the chair as well, and probably three, they haven't got the money, the 750 quid. So the Parsons Road gang, helped by Dexter and Brian and Melody, they come up with this idea, ingenious plan to raise money. They're going to do loads of fundraising, they're going to do sponsored walks, sponsored swims, they're going to do everything it takes to help Addy raise the money to get his new wheelchair. And as they get close to raising the money for the chair, the money which they keep in a shed at Brian's house disappears, all gone, and there's just one mask left. On the mask, there's a really scary message, a note left for Addy, basically saying that he'll never make it in the basketball team, and all the money's gone.
Addy's met his nemesis, and who is the masked marauder? Well, we'll have to read on, won't we?
Yes, you will do. The note is signed off the masked marauder, and it's left with a mask. So they've got to find who the masked marauder is. They've got to raise enough money for Addy to get a wheelchair so he could play in the basketball league before it starts. So they haven't got much time, and they've got to convince Addy's parents to allow him to play basketball. And also on top of that, Melody is trying to become the first female to play in the football team at the school. And she's good enough to play in the team, but she's also having to deal with their old nemesis, Spencer Frogley, as well. He's the captain of the football team, and he doesn't like girls, and he doesn't want girls playing in the football team. So there's loads of things going on.
It really is the perfect book for World Book Day, isn't it? I mean, it shows kids that there are mountains to climb in life, and you mustn't be put off. You've just got to carry on trying, and hopefully you'll achieve your dreams. And the book's going to be released on World Book Day, isn't it?
Yeah, World Book Day. I think it's great. Anything that encourages kids to read and to buy books, and also encourages them to use their imagination. That's what it's all about. I'm super excited to see loads of pictures of children going to school dressed up as Cyborg Cat and the Parsons Road Gang. For me, that will make my year. I'm going to be at quite a few book festivals. I've had lots of kids approach me online talking about whether they can get Cyborg Cat outfits and ideas of making Cyborg Cat outfits to go to school on World Book Day, which is really, really awesome to see that the children have picked up on it. But I'll be everywhere. I will be ubiquitous all over the country.
That's great. It shows kids who have disabilities that the challenges that are thrown at you, you can overcome them and you can achieve your dreams. I mean, it's a long way from how you grew up. I mean, you presumably can't begin to imagine how much success you've had.
It is bonkers. I was speaking to you before we started this interview about the fact that just under 2 weeks ago, I was in the Himalayas, flying over the Himalayas in a helicopter for a series that I'm making about climate change. And as I was flying over this incredible wonder of the world in this helicopter, I was just thinking, I've come a long way from that kid from Plasto, East London, who was born in Lagos, Nigeria, with a disability. And I'm now doing this on top of the world, quite literally on top of the world. And I think that's what the book is about, is to show, yes, there will be obstacles. Yes, there will be challenges. But, you know, with friendship, with determination and with hard work, you can overcome those things. And it's also just saying, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, you can achieve your dreams. There are avenues, there are places for you to go, and there's so much for you to achieve. So yeah, it's a real positive, lots of energy and lots of fun in the book.
I know that books were a major feature in your upbringing, and they helped open your eyes to what you could achieve.
Yeah, I loved reading, because the thing about books is the only thing that limits it is your imagination. I got to read about people doing all sorts of things all over the world. I got to understand about different ways of life, from the kids' books that I read to the science fiction books that I read to the adventure books that I read. It opened my mind to new possibilities. I really hope that Cyborg Cat and the Masked Marauder and the whole Cyborg Cat series does that. And it's not just for disabled kids, it's for every child, it's for everyone out there to read.
Adia Deputan, I know you've got to get back to narrating the book, and I shall let you get on, but thank you so much for coming into the studio and being our guest again today on Read On.
Oh, Ed, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks again to Adia. Cyborg Cat and the Masked Marauder is out now wherever you buy your books. And if you'd like to hear more about Ade's life in his own words, why not download Amazing Olympians from the RNIB Library, which is TB704733. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. This week sees the long-anticipated publication of the concluding part of Hilary Mantel's Thomas Cromwell trilogy, which began with Wolf Hall in 2009. Bring Up the Bodies followed in 2012 and, like Wolf Hall, won the Booker Prize. Can The Mirror and the Light make it an unprecedented hat-trick of bookers for Hilary Mantel later this year? Robert Kirkwood, who interviewed Hilary Mantel on both previous occasions, presents this insight into one of Britain's most intriguing authors.
Since her first novel, Every Day is Mother's Day, published in 1985, until around mid-2009, Hilary Mantel was a relatively unknown author, described as a best-kept secret of literature. Now, although her fiction, short stories and memoirs were themselves award winners, it wasn't until that Booker win catapulted her onto bookshelves all over the world. A rise and rise that continued with her second Booker win, Bring Up the Bodies, in 2012. And now, 8 years later, we are so familiar with this publishing phenomenon that a billboard appeared in the West End bearing nothing but the words Now Get Up and a Tudor rose, and we knew that The Mirror and the Light is finally here. I first spoke to her in 2009 after her Booker win, and after the RNIB talking book version of Wolf Hall was recorded by Christopher Oxford.
Stand up straight, Catherine murmurs, like a princess of England. Braced against the chair back, Mary takes a deep breath. She turns to him, her plain, pinched face, hard as Norfolk's thumbnail. It is early afternoon, very hot. The sun casts against the wall, shifting squares of lilac and gold. The shrivelled fields of Windsor are laid out below them. The Thames shrinks from its banks. The Queen speaks in English. Do you know who this is? This is Master Cromwell, who now writes all the laws.
Wolf Hall is a novel I've been thinking about for a long time, maybe 20-odd years. I've been thinking one of these days I'll get round to Thomas Cromwell. Thomas Cromwell, Henry VIII's minister, is the hero. He's at the centre of court affairs in the very busy decade of the 1530s, when he's Henry's right-hand man. But I take you back to his early life. Thomas Cromwell's background for a courtier was very unusual. He was born in Putney around about 1485. His father, Walter, was a brewer and a blacksmith. He was a violent man. He was a heavy drinker. Round about 15 years old, Thomas Cromwell ran away from home, crossed the Channel, joined the French army, then began on a series of adventures, about which we know startlingly little, except that they took him all over Europe. He came back to England in his late 20s, speaking many languages, and apparently knowing a bit about, well, most of the things you might want to know about. Finance, the cloth trade, commercial law. Went into the service of Cardinal Wolsey, and from there transferred into the King's service, and made the most amazing career rising from his beginnings in the blacksmith's yard to be Earl of Essex.
Hilary Mantel on Wolf Hall. We were talking in 2009, and reviews of the book reflected the politics of the day and had compared Cromwell to Alistair Campbell with an axe.
I think Thomas Cromwell probably had a little bit more subtlety, at least than in our popular picture of Alistair Campbell. I would say the axe was hidden behind his back. But certainly he was a very powerful man. He was a very ruthless man. He wouldn't have been any use to a king like Henry VIII if he'd been any other way. He was also tremendously clever, quite charming, a good conversationalist, good company, well-read and interested in everything. Quite an appealing character in many ways, although in popular English history and in the novel, he's often painted as a kind of pantomime villain.
What I noticed from the novel is you may not like the decisions he's making, but you can see why he's making them.
Yes, the point is about this novel, you're standing in his shoes. So you are following him at every step of the twisty-turny political path. And you always have to say, in this situation, what would I do? Would I do any better?
Now, do you think our image of Cromwell has been tainted by the Robert Bolt play A Man for All Seasons?
Definitely. It's been influential as a play and as a film for two generations. It's very good drama, and that's why. As history, of course, it's hugely biased in favour of Thomas More. There's nothing particularly wrong with that, because a novelist or a dramatist really doesn't have to be impartial in the way that a historian has to, but I do think they have to be informed and they have to work on the basis of the facts. They must treat the facts honourably. Now, Bolt's version is highly partisan, but then so is my book. And I thought it's time we had another look at Thomas Cromwell. And my book isn't consciously an attempt to rehabilitate him. I doubt if he should need that. But it's an attempt to walk forward, as I say, imagining that you were in his shoes and seeing the world from his point of view. And from that point of view, Thomas More looks very different from the hero of Robert Bolt's play, who has, after all, not worn too well, because Robert Bolt's Thomas More is really a 1960s liberal. An idea which would have made the real Thomas More turn in his grave.
Now, how would you describe yourself then, as a historian or a novelist?
Oh, very much as a novelist. But I probably take the historical side of my work more seriously than many historical novelists. Because for me, it's the facts that spring imaginary constructs, that spring metaphor, its objects, documents, the source material, everything grows out of them, and artifacts like portraits and so on. So I have to have all the basic work in place, and I'll be pretty dogged in pursuing a fact that appears to be missing. But then, of course, we do come up against the gaps, to the great frustration of historians and biographers, as well as novelists. And it's just that I think there comes a point where the biographer, say, has to draw back and say, beyond this, it's mere speculation. But everybody knows that that's part of the novelist's trade. So you can push ahead into those dark areas and try to find out something of that life that we know must be there, but which hasn't come down to us. Cromwell, his public career is very well documented, but his private life, to a large extent, is hidden. And yet, we know that it existed. Like everyone else, there was a personal side to his life. Like everyone else, he was seething with memories and dreams and maybe regrets and hopes for the future. So what the novelist can do on the basis of the fact, speculate about what these hopes and fears and dreams may have been and try and reconstruct a character from the inside.
Now, how long did it take to research this book?
Well, I have been thinking about it, as I explained, for quite a long time. But when I finally decided I was going to do it, and the time had come, I would say about 5 years in the research and writing.
Madam, shall we go on in English or Latin? Your cardinal would ask the same question, as if I were a stranger here. I will say to you, as I said to him, that I was first addressed as Princess of Wales when I was 3 years old. I was 16 when I came here to marry my Lord Arthur. I was a virgin, and 17 when he died. I was 24 years old when I became Queen of England, and I will say, for the avoidance of doubt, that I am at present aged 46, and still Queen, and by now, I believe, a sort of Englishwoman.
Wolf Hall is the name of the Seymour's house in Wiltshire. It's still there, although nowadays there's a Victorian farmhouse on the site. But Wolf Hall, I liked it, you know, for its metaphorical resonance. In a sense, everywhere that Henry goes is Wolf Hall. He's surrounded by his predatory pack of snapping courtiers. But also Wolf Hall as a real house is the destination point of all the characters. At the very end of the book, Henry is off on his summer holidays, summer progress. He's going to travel across the West Country. And one of the places he's going to visit when he's on his way back to London, he's got 4 or 5 days, early September, and he's going to go to Wolf Hall. And that's how the book ends, with Cromwell writing the itinerary and writing in these words, Wolf Hall. And I like the idea of a book that was always in progress, right till its final two words.
In the convivial days between Christmas and New Year, while the court is feasting and Charles Brandon is in the fens shouting at a door, he is rereading Marsilio of Padua. In the year 1324, Marsilio put to us 42 propositions. When the Feast of the Epiphany is passed, he ambles along to put a few of them to Henry. Some of these propositions the king knows, some are strange to him, some are congenial in his present situation, some have been denounced to him as heresy. It's a morning of brilliant, bone-chilling cold, the wind off the river like a knife in the face. We are breezing in to push our luck.
You see, this story, King has 6 wives, kills 2 of them, divorces 2 of them. You couldn't make it up. You absolutely couldn't. People would accuse you of being melodramatic. And yet, these are the facts of English history. So, I think we're brought very close to these people on a human level. Even though the Tudors were very different from us, there is something in common in the psychological setup here. Henry was a very modern man in many ways. He was a great romantic. And in an age of arranged marriages, Henry wanted to be in love with his wives. So when he wanted to get rid of his first wife, Catherine of Aragon, the fact that he'd long ago fallen out of love with her was part of it, I think. And his plan, because he didn't have a son to succeed him, his fellow monarchs sympathised. Even the Pope could have been brought to sympathise. Annulments like that were granted all the time. So Henry's path should have been easy. But he went and fell in love with a totally unsuitable woman. Not the French princess everyone expected him to marry, but Anne Boleyn, the daughter of a mere gentleman, with something of a past.
something of a question mark, certainly, hanging over her sexual history. So, falling in love was what really complicated Henry's life. Then he fell out of love and developed a great passion for Jane Seymour, who was going to be wife number three. And in the course of time, a marriage was arranged to Anne of Cleves, whom he couldn't love at all. Of course, the men of his generation didn't understand his hesitation. Why didn't he just hop into bed with the girl and do the business? But Henry wasn't like that. His psychology wasn't set up that way. We've all known, I think, women who are something like Henry's first wife, Catherine of Aragon, in that they're a career wife and they'll hang on to a dead marriage. And we've all known someone like Anne Boleyn, who's the mistress on the make. So even though there's a yawning gap of 500 years, we can still look at the world about us and we can find comparisons. What we have to remember, of course, is that Henry didn't know he was going to have six wives. Even when he was up to wife number five, he didn't know it. So we have to get rid of any idea that these things were preordained and see these people as human beings moving through history with no foresight, only a lot of muddle and misinformation around them. And I think this period of history, because it's so personal, it makes it very human. And also, there's another thing about Henry's reign which is interesting, in that women have been bit players in the English monarchy until now. But suddenly, a woman and her body and what her body can do is centre stage. It's the absolutely vital factor, because what Henry needs and wants more than anything is a son and the woman who will give him a son. And the whole politics of the reign begin to centre around this question of a woman's body.
Now, you mentioned Jane Seymour. You don't portray her as the milksop that she's portrayed as sometimes.
We don't know an awful lot about Jane historically, but what we do know suggests that when the king cast his eye on her, she played her hand very, very coolly indeed. If she'd been intent on reeling him in, and if she'd been planning it for years, she couldn't have done better. So she understood Henry, and I think she understood the power play of the court and how to use it to her advantage. So Jane, simply because we don't know much about her, is often assumed to have been a kind of non-person, a sort of dumb blonde. But the fact is, everything we do know about her suggests that here's a woman with a good wit and a good brain in her head, and the cool courage to exercise it.
And this is interesting. I asked about a sequel, and it seems that Bring Up the Bodies was once going to be called The Mirror and the Light.
There is going to be a sequel. I'm working on it now, or at least I will be when I stop jaunting around the country and doing the post-booker publicity. It's called The Mirror and the Light, and it's going to take Thomas Cromwell to the heights of power through the next 5 years. He's going to see the destruction of Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour become queen, give Henry his longed-for heir, Jane's death, and the disastrous marriage with Anne of Cleves, and Henry's fifth wife, Catherine Howard, on the horizon. There's civil war. There are all sorts of upheavals in the Cromwell household. I can promise that it will just be even more charged with events, if that's possible, than the first book. And I can't wait to be at it, because in some ways I feel as if when I finished Wolf Hall, I left them there with their suitcases packed, ready to hit the road. And I really want to be back there with them.
and she did get back to them in Bring Up the Bodies. And the two planned books became three. The RNIB version of Bring Up the Bodies is once again read by Christopher Oxford.
His children are falling from the sky. He watches from horseback, acres of England stretching behind him. They drop, gilt-winged, each with a blood-filled gaze. Grace Cromwell hovers in thin air. She is silent when she takes her prey, silent as she glides to his fist. But the sounds she makes then, the rustle of feathers, and the creak, the sigh and riffle of pinion, the small cluck-cluck from her throat, these are sounds of recognition, intimate, daughterly, almost disapproving. Her breast is gore-streaked, and flesh clings to her claws.
I spoke to Hilary on the phone, and first of all, I asked her how this moment felt.
The winner of the 2012 Man Booker Prize for Fiction is Bring Up the Bodies by Hilary Mantel.
I was just incredibly surprised. I come to the evening very, very tense, but fully expecting to walk away empty-handed. I suppose everybody thinks, well, you know, I'm not that lucky. I'm not going to win again. You think my life's not like that.
Now, I've heard you say that Bring Up the Bodies was a much harder book to write than Wolf Hall. Was part of that difficulty because the previous book had won the Booker and there was perhaps a little more pressure on you this time?
It was more difficult, only in the writing itself. It took more out of me. It was much more intense. It wasn't technically more difficult. It was only difficult in the wear and tear on the emotions. And I have to say, really, when you sit down to write and you're deeply immersed in a project, the last thing you're thinking about is prizes. In my experience, you're only thinking about your material. So I wasn't at any point in writing that book thinking, I wonder how this will do with the Man Booker Prize. I was only concentrating on getting my story told and seeing my characters through to their various endpoints.
Now, you mentioned there the word intense, and there's certainly a much more intense period of time in this book.
Yes. Wolf Hall is a big, sprawling book, and the action covers 30 years, and even more because it goes back into prehistory, into myth, to look at the myths about how Britain began. But Bring Up the Bodies, which starts where Wolf Hall leaves off in the September of 1535. It covers only a 9-month span, and of that 9 months, the last half of the book covers about 3 weeks as the events lead up to the climax of the execution of Anne Boleyn.
Now, we know it leads up to that execution. Do you think it's strange that everyone knows the ending to this book apart from the characters in the book?
Yes. What I try to do is to put the reader in the same imaginative plane as the characters, so the reader doesn't perceive it as inevitable, but the reader sees the turning points that caused history to work out the way it did.
Now, what do you prefer writing about? The light areas that are well documented in history or the dark areas of these times that we know nothing about?
I suppose with the light areas, then you think, well, a thing may be well documented, but there may be versions of that documentation. There may be gaps in that documentation. There may be documents that should exist but don't exist. You have something to hang on to. But even with an event that appears to be well documented, you're saying, who's telling me this? Why do they want me to believe this? Is there another version told from another point of view? And where are the gaps? And so, in some respects, if you approach all documentation and all of what we refer to as recorded history in that same spirit of scepticism, then in some ways the difference between the light and the dark areas vanishes, because what you see is the shadow behind the light. And so there is really nothing I take for granted beyond, you know, those established days in the calendar on which the axe fell. We often know what happened, but it's the why. That's what I'm dealing in. And every why is dappled with both the light and the dark.
Do you think she, Anne Boleyn, sorry, was guilty of adultery?
No, I think she probably wasn't. But that doesn't mean that I see her as a victim. I think it was a fact that she was not a victim. She was a political player, and she was a big player on the political scene, and she went into battle and she lost. I don't think she herself would have liked to be seen as a victim. Having said that, I know that she was living her life against the backdrop of a culture that was misogynistic. It was an easy accusation to fling against a woman, and utterly destructive, the idea of a queen who broke her marriage vows, because what you're saying here is a queen who could put an illegitimate child on the throne of England, a queen who could pull the wool over a nation's eyes. Any accusation of that type levelled against Anne came very near the question of national security. There's a very fine line there between adultery and treason. I think that although we will never know, I think the probability was that she was sitting up, but she had created the climate in which that could occur. You cannot imagine how the same mechanism could have been used to destroy Henry's first queen, Catherine of Aragon. He simply couldn't. She was above reproach. That's not to say that it was Anne's fault in any way, but I do think that, you know, she was part of the political scene in which she rose and fell. She was not a doll. She was not a passive victim.
Now, what period will you cover in the next book, The Mirror and the Light?
I will take the story up probably at that moment when Anne Boleyn's head falls, as Thomas Cromwell and his son and his colleagues are walking away from the scaffold. And I will continue till 1540, till Cromwell's own death on the same scaffold in the Tower of London.
Now, there's definitely only going to be one more book, because you said there was going to be two and then there was three. Do you think there might be a fourth?
No, I think the arc of this one is pretty clear. There is no calamitous event, no central event like the fall of Anne Boleyn. In the first book, everything led to the death of Thomas More. In the second, everything led to the death of Anne Boleyn. In the third, everything leads to the death of Cromwell, which doesn't mean to say it's a story of Cromwell's fall, because it's a story of his rise and rise and rise. But what happens now is that the pattern changes. Instead of working towards one great climax in the action, from now on, every day is more or less a crisis for Cromwell.
Mm.
There are no downtimes. There are no quiet times. There is no prospect of reflection or recollection or ease. He's living in an intensely pressurized environment, watching his enemies grouping, sometimes defeating them, but then finally not defeating them.
And when do you think we'll see the final book?
Well, now, about that I'm making no predictions. Works of fiction are inherently unpredictable, which is why my one book turned into two and my two into three.
Hmm.
But I intend to work on it very hard next year. As far as I can, I'm pushing other commitments aside. Already they are creeping into my diary, things that can't be helped. But I do hope to spend the bulk of that year concentrating. And at the end of it, I will see where I get. I wouldn't like it to be later than 2015.
Now let's hear that last bit again.
I wouldn't like it to be later than 2015.
But now, 5 years later than initially planned, The Mirror and the Light is here. In fact, if you're listening to this on the day of release, it came out yesterday in print and audio commercially, and the audio version is already in the RNIB library, with a Braille version on its way. The audiobook is narrated by Ben Miles, who was personally cast by Hilary Mantel.
Once the Queen's head is severed, he walks away. A sharp pang of appetite reminds him that it is time for a second breakfast, or perhaps an early dinner. The morning's circumstances are new, and there are no rules to guide us. The witnesses, who have knelt for the passing of the soul, stand up and put on their hats. Under the hats, their faces are stunned. But then he turns back to say a word of thanks to the executioner. The man has performed his office with style, and though the king is paying him well, it is important to reward good service with encouragement as well as a purse. Having once been a poor man, he knows this from experience. The small body lies on the scaffold where it has fallen, belly down, hands outstretched. It swims in a pool of crimson, the blood seeping between the planks. The Frenchmen, they had sent for the Calais executioner, had picked up the head, swaddled it in linen, then handed it to one of the veiled women who had attended Anne in her last moments. He saw how, as she received the bundle, the woman shuddered from the nape of her neck to her feet. She held it fast, though, and a head is heavier than you expect. Having been on a battlefield, he knows this from experience, too. The women have done well. Anne would have been proud of them. They will not let any man touch her. Palms out, they force back those who try to help them. They slide in the gore and stoop over the narrow carcass. He hears their indrawn breath as they lift what is left of her. Holding her by her clothes, they are afraid the cloth will rip and their fingers touch her cooling flesh.
Both Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies are available in Braille, giant print, and as TB16735 and TB19919, respectively. Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but we'll be back at the same time next week. We're also available as a podcast. Just search your provider for Read On, the audiobook show, to subscribe, rate, or leave a review. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSail, which is REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at Talking_Books. Farewell until next week and the next chapter of Read On.